Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of food, health, and the environment, and each week on Connect the Dots, we talk about different things in our interconnected world that affect us and our health, the health of humans and other species, the health of our food, water, air, and earth, the health of our communities, the health of our society, and the ecological stability and balance of our habitat, planet Earth. Each week on the show, I talk to different thought leaders, experts, filmmakers, advocates, scientists, authors, poets, all kinds of different people who are impassioned and informing us and expert in different among the many interconnected arenas that all come together to create life here on our wonderful living systems planet. On today's show, I am delighted to have a return guest to Connect the Dots, that is someone whom I've been privileged to know, admire, and actually, you know, support the work that we have all done together in New York State for a healthy environment. My guests today, there are two of them, are Sandra Steingraber, biologist, mother, and cancer survivor. Sandra has a PhD and is an internationally recognized authority on the environmental links to public health. Holding a doctorate in biology and a master's degree in creative writing, she has written three books about human health and the environment, including Living Downstream, which was also released as a documentary film in 2010. From this deep and very well-grounded background, Sandra has been a leader in activism. She's been honored with the Heinz Award, the Rachel Carson Leadership Award, and, you know, the Environmental Health Champion Award from Physicians for Social Responsibility, the Hero Award from the Breast Cancer Fund. And Sandra, I know as the co-founder of New Yorkers Against Fracking and Concerned Health Professionals of New York, for her terrific work in our state and now nationally as well, in working with Americans Against Fracking, to really raise awareness about the health, community, and you know, intense environmental impacts of fracking, fossil fuels, pipeline development, and all these energy infrastructures that have significant downsides that in, you know, the rush to produce have not been adequately considered, but thanks to her work, you know, are much more there's much more public knowledge about them. I myself have covered fracking, as listeners to the show will know, since about 2009, and I often say that aside from all the work that our, you know, Northeastern community did in obtaining a fracking ban in New York State in 2014, and Sandra was, you know, without a doubt, the prime leader in that fight. But I also say that one of our minor wins is that when I share an item on Facebook and use the word fracking, the autocorrect no longer corrects it from, you know, to tracking, but will, in fact, take the F and let me write fracking without an autocorrection. It was so little known when we began, and now, of course, everyone knows what it is. Joining us as well today is the filmmaker of the film that brings these two guests to our show today. It's going to be premiering in New York later this week, and it's called Unfractured. The filmmaker is also joining us. Her name is Shanda Chavanis. She's a producer and director of Unfractured and previously produced the feature-length film Living Downstream with Sandra Steingraber. She's a Canadian filmmaker, writer, and educator, who also has won many awards and actually lived in sub-Saharan Africa, which is a fascinating thing. I don't know if we'll get to that today. But she is also a graduate of Sheridan College's Media Arts Program and an instructor at Centennial College's Story Arts Center. And as we can see from the film Unfractured, which we'll be talking about on today's show, she is also a master of storytelling. So welcome to Connect the Dots, Sandra and Chanda.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. You know, one of the things that this film does, which is so rare, is there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of, especially in independent media coverage, of various advocacy causes that affect us in deep ways, as fracking does. And so, you know, we're always hearing about things that are, you know, people are aware and tuned in, I should say, are frequently, you know, hearing about issues, looking at the things that we kind of could be doing better. Instead of fracking, we could be going toward renewable energy is one example. Looking at the effects of, you know, the harm that's created by some of the society's poor choices. And, you know, we're really frequently looking at that. And I think there are many of us who are really committed and thrive on knowing the truth, knowing the information, participating and being involved. But, you know, the thing that's rarely seen, rarely spoken about is the human side of advocacy. And to me, that's what's really unique about this film, because really it takes a hero, or a heroine to, you know, take the time not for personal gain, not for personal profit, not for being, you know, successful as society measures it in many ways, not for fulfilling one's personal needs and family responsibilities, you know, but really, you know, reaching deep into our sense of caring and commitment to devote time and effort and talent and skill and, you know, one's very life and the hours of a lifetime to a cause that's bigger than oneself. And that is very rarely portrayed, you know, as a human experience and as a human option. And, you know, this is what's extraordinary about this film is I think it does a fantastic job of doing something that hasn't been done enough. And one of the reasons why this film is so exceptional, too, is because, you know, it centers on you, Sandra, and your work and your personal authenticity and the challenges, you know, that are real and that you face and that you took on, which are challenges that many people might really be daunted by. Can you just acquaint our listeners a bit, you know, why you have ended up as being, you know, this extraordinary champion of the fight to protect our health and clean water and food and you know, to defend our communities and our planet from the tremendous harms inflicted by fossil fuel use and development, and in particular fracking. Can you, you know, explain why this, you know, this cause inspired you and why you took this up? Like, what happened?
Sure. Well, I think it's a moment in history that requires all of us to become champions, as you say. Superheroes is the word that I've used because my son loves superheroes, so we all have to wear a cape now. And I think that the story of how we stopped fracking in New York is a story of thousands of superheroes. It was amazing to me to see the people around me put it all on the line to stop this industry from turning our communities into a factory floor for more fossil fuel extraction, right? People retired early so they had time to fight. People maxed out their credit cards so they could get on the bus to Albany and rally. People took out second mortgages on their homes to finance their activism. And so I'm just one voice in all this, but I'm a voice that Shanda profiled, and so the camera actually witnesses my transformation from one kind of activist to another. I mean, I appreciate your list of all of the awards I've been lucky enough to receive, but most of them, including the Heinz Award, was for very careful, painstaking, evidence-based work of bringing science out of the obscurity of the peer-reviewed literature, translating it into plain-spoken English, and writing about it or speaking about it for communities that need good science so that they can go to the barricades with it, or for our elected officials so that we bring good science to public policy making. So even in Shanda's previous movie, Living Downstream, I describe myself as somebody who's a two-way translator between the world of science and activism. So in real life and in this film about this life, I became, through the course of fighting fracking, a warrior on the front lines, and eventually that my conscience led me to risk arrest as a civil disobedient and go to jail, and the camera follows me deftly through that whole transformation as well. So I guess what I'm saying is that it's almost a conservative impulse that I have. It's one that I grew up with, my father being a World War II veteran. He was a teenage combatant in occupied Italy who was fond of quoting Winston Churchill. And one of the things that Churchill said a lot was that you can't just try your best, you have to do what's required. And I felt very strongly that what was required in that moment for me to be a good mother was to protect my children's community, protect their air and water, protect their future by stopping this industry. The irony being that in the course of doing that, I had to absent myself from their lives. And that's the crux of my internal conflict, that somehow it's not a really cinematic conflict. So many women walk around with these conflicting impulses, and I don't know how you can capture that cinematically.
The film does capture it cinematically.
It does. And I think... for me, one of the unexpected things that happened, because life is always full of unexpected things, during the course of this years-long battle was that my husband became a stroke patient and suffered from repeated strokes of unknown origin. So that was all going on while I was at the front lines. So there are scenes, of me visiting him in the hospital because he's aphasic and I need to check in with his caregivers. But I'm on my way to Albany to a rally, So there's, so the camera's in there with me during all these moments.
Yeah, that's really, it's touching and amazing. And one of the things that was so incredibly inspiring about it is that women, like many women, play the role, as mothers, as family members, as community members, play the role of caregivers. We're caring for other people. It's not that men don't do it too, but it's much more traditionally a primary responsibility of women. And yet it's rather rare for that caregiving to go beyond the immediate home, the immediate community, the immediate neighborhood, and go out into society to take care of something that would, that's coming down the pike toward our children, that will be negatively impacting them unless we do something. And I think it's kind of, very often, like in the battle against fracking, these are large infrastructures. We're dealing with government agencies like FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. We're dealing with public officials like Governor Cuomo or the senators or local congresspeople or representatives. We're dealing with massive multinational corporations who have strong financial interests and allies and markets that we oppose. We oppose their enacting their activities without regard, for the human and ecological impacts. And yet this isn't, it's kind of not normally seen as a woman's role. These things are, I think many people feel overpowered and frightened of them before they even begin. They would even begin considering moving into action against them. But for you, that's been a very natural extension of your maternal impulse. How you know, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that and how that came about and, you know, what you think about that in terms of what you've encountered.
I'm not sure I agree with the premise of the question in a way. I think that actually women are all over in public life, leading the charge on all manner of issues, whether it is, you know, Black Lives Matter led by black women, LGBTQ issues, civil rights issues, environmental issues. I mean, there are women in the in leadership roles everywhere and have public voices. I think they're done. They're not films about them. I think they're not books about us. I think that we need the camera to bring these stories to life. And that's why I feel so privileged that to work with Shanda, because she's devoted her life to doing that. And I guess today, because it's election day, you know, I mean, that's when we're talking, right? And so I just cast my own vote. And before I did, I sat down and read some of the words of the suffragette activists of 100 years ago. And, you know, I mean, you know, here's what Victoria Woodhull had to say. If Congress refused to listen to and grant what women ask, there is but one course left then to pursue. What is there left for women to do but to become the mothers of the future government? And so, I mean, the women were doing that 100 years ago. And if we don't know who Victoria Woodhull is, it's because their stories haven't, their narratives haven't been brought to us, right? And they're juniors. Even Rachel Carson, I think, has become a kind of forgotten figure at this point. And she was a biologist like me, a writer like me, who toiled mightily to bring science into the public arena and make it do battle with bad policy. And we need more filmmakers like Shanda to tell their stories.
Shanda, what was your, you know, what moved you to do this? When did it occur to you that this, that following Sandra and showing this human side of engagement was really, you know, the like something that people needed to see?
Well, I think for me, there were two parts of it, right? So when we had worked on Living Downstream together, the story that we told in that film was very retrospective. It told of Sandra's diagnosis with cancer at 20, and it told of her search for information about the environmental links to cancer. And what we didn't do is we didn't kind of follow a story as it was unfolding, because it had already unfolded. And I love the idea of kind of following a story and not quite knowing where it was going to end up. And so as we were releasing Living Downstream, I was watching as Sandra was really involved in the anti-fracking movement. And I was just very inspired by what she was doing and what others in the movement were doing. And I was kind of always on the edge of my seat. I never knew what was going to happen next. And as someone just watching YouTube videos, I was pulled in, and I just thought, this has the makings of an amazing film. And then I saw an interview with Sandra on Bill Moyers before she was about to go to jail for the first time for blockading a gas storage site. And Bill Moyers asked her about her kids, you know, you're going to go to jail, who's going to take care of your kids? And this was before Sandra's husband, Jeff, had had any strokes. And Sandra said, well, they have a father. He's going to look after them. And to me, that really struck a chord, because it's the same question that I get asked whenever I travel for work and I talk about my kids. If I'm somewhere other than Toronto, which is where I live, people say, who's taking care of your kids? And I say, their father is. And that was frustrating to me, because I do feel like women are expected to answer for where they are at all times if they're not with their children. And it's a struggle that we face internally, but it's a struggle that is put onto us by society as well. And so I wanted to just reflect that, to honor it, but also to, in conversations like that, challenge it a little bit as well.
You know, one of the things that really struck me is that we, you know, in the film Unfractured, we see, you know, Sandra going from, you know, the privacy and intimacy, you know, of being with your, you know, your husband in the hospital, as decisions are being made and his health is being assessed and there's a mystery, you know, to getting on a bus, traveling with other people, and then, you know, speaking before a large crowd with a huge assembly of people there, fighting together, you know, from the most private things to the most public things in the course of a single day. And, you know, many people, I don't know, would, I mean, that's like such a an incredible range of human experience to be able to embrace and encompass and function through. I mean, how do you do it? What are your, you know, what resources do you call upon to support you in the energy and, you know, in doing the right thing, and in being present in, you know, in all of those spaces in the right way, you know, with such a wide diversity of things that you hold?
Well, I lead a pretty privileged life as a PhD biologist, right? I know a lot of things, and one of the things I know is that air pollution of the type that fracking produces inevitably is linked to stroke risk. And so, yes, you know, I was at Jeff's side translating his needs to his caregivers and helping make decisions as to what treatments and what diagnostic procedures he should and shouldn't have. But the other half of that is to make sure that when he returns to fell him again. I mean, stroke is cruel. It's the most cruel thing I've ever seen. And you know, I'm a cancer survivor, so I've seen a lot of ways that chronic illness can dehumanize us. But, you know, Jeff is a jazz musician and an artist, and the stroke took his dominant hand away from him, so he can no longer draw the way he used to, and he can't play the kind of chords he would like to, and it took away his speech. So tool use and speech are the two things that make us humans. And so it's a cruel, cruel thing. So I felt it was part of my job in taking care of this person I care for so deeply to ensure that he has a good environment to come back home to. And also, frankly, you know, the kind of, okay, so I did courageous things, you know. I didn't sleep a lot. I went all in. And, you know, one of the things that I did that wasn't so cinematic, that didn't involve handcuffs and rallies where I gave speeches, was to help people write informed, when we could all weigh in on fracking, that we had good science behind them. And we were only given 30 days to send comments in, and it was the 30 days right over the Christmas and Hanukkah holidays. I helped orchestrate some of that and provided good science for people to include in their comments. And we had hoped through this campaign to maybe direct 1,000 comments toward Albany. And in the end, more than 500,000 comments came in. It was basically, we buried the draft regulations that were going to greenlight fracking under a barrage of sentences written by citizens. And in doing that, we actually halted the regulations from being rolled out because the Department of Environmental Conservation couldn't respond to them all before the deadline elapsed. So that was a key turning point in our campaign. More science came in, and the case against fracking became more damning. But what the point I want to make about that is that there were people hooked up to IV drips and chemotherapy drips in hospitals who were writing their comments with, you know, their non-dominant hand while they were receiving chemotherapy. So there was courage all around, and that's what these battles take, is immense courage. And so it feels good to cast off fear and anxiety and take everything that you have, your entire skill set, and give it over to a human rights movement and help in, you know, if you're in a battle, if you're in a sort of David versus Goliath battle and you want to be David, what you need is really good slingshot design. And that takes a whole bunch of people pretty hard. I think this slingshot that we all came up with that won the day was a slingshot made up of, and I actually say this in the film, love, science, and grassroots political power. I mean, we built out a base so large that the governor had to make a decision. Either he could disrespect the wishes of a huge part of his political base, or he could disrespect the wishes of the gas industry. And we needed to become more powerful than the gas industry in our numbers and in our ability to vote and take action and be political citizens, so that the governor would prefer to cross the gas industry rather than to cross us. And that's what we did. And that took acts of courage and inspiration, but mostly just pure, relentless, like dog with a bone determination and a willingness to just never surrender.
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely fantastic and, you know, and just beautiful. And I remember I was standing on a New York City subway platform, Columbus Circle, when someone texted me the news that the fracking ban had come through. And I began, you know, crying and calling other people. It's one of these things that was just a seminal moment of enormous victory and great relief and thankfulness when it happened. You know, I don't know if you're prepared for this question, and, you know, if it's too much, just let me know. But I can't help but ask you, as we are currently facing tremendous political dilemmas, you know, we have a government in effect that is rampantly controlled, by the fossil fuel industry and enacting its wishes to the detriment of climate and communities and health all across the United States. And here we have our battle, which, you know, is not the last battle, because the film also shows the battle to prevent, this beautiful upstate community from being used as a storage waste facility for energy waste. And, you know, and there's always this search to bury it and put it here and there, because there's very little remediation possible. But, you know, we've had these victories. We've had some losses. You know, the battle to prevent the Dakota Access Pipeline, which I've covered on this program. You know, unfortunately, despite the valiant efforts of many people, that pipeline has proceeded. And now we have these, you know, at the highest level of government, we have the fossil fuel agenda being unceremoniously rolled out, while the environmental regulations and policies and controls and protections are being stripped down. You know, what message could you offer people in terms of how we can renew our courage and prevail to protect the earth in our current situation, our current political situation?
Well, again, I mean, we don't want to be good Germans, right? Nobody likes good Germans.
That's right.
If things are going on that are wrong, if our country and our democratic institutions are being corrupted, then we can either be silent, and silence is a form of consent, or we can rise up. And history looks at those who rise up as the heroes of our time, right? So why not live life heroically? I don't see that we have a choice here. And I also think it's always good to take a historical perspective on this. You know, things looked really bad during the Civil Rights Movement when the Freedom Riders were massacred. Things looked really bad during the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. They had almost no chance of winning, but they had to send up an SOS signal and a signal of defiant resistance, even though they knew they were going to be slaughtered, to let the rest of the world know they needed to have the courage of their convictions. Again, you know, I grew up listening to Winston Churchill, "We shall fight them on the beaches, you know, we shall fight them everywhere, and we shall never surrender." So there are people in the past who took on acts of enormous courage. My own son, Elijah, is named after one of them, Elijah Lovejoy, an abolitionist from my own home state of Illinois, who also was the father of two young children, the father of one child, and his wife was pregnant with the next. who knew that if he continued to publish his abolitionist newspaper, he was almost certainly going to be assassinated. He begged the Illinois Congress to give him some kind of protection from these pro-slavery mobs that were coming over from across the Mississippi and Missouri slave state, and they refused. They basically said, look, if you don't want to feel like your life's in danger, just stop saying these things against slavery. And he wrote his own mother to say, what shall I do? You know, my children will grow up without a father if I abandon my post. I don't want that, but I can't imagine my children living in a world with slavery. It's a homicidal abomination. And he finally kept publishing, and sure enough, he was pumped full of 5 bullets and died on his, I think, 35th birthday, or was buried then. And his worst fears were realized, and his children grew up impoverished because his widow had to go out and take in laundry or something. But the point is that his life and his work served as an example and inspired people all across the nation, including a guy named Henry Beecher, who was the president of Illinois College, who then turned his own and Henry Beecher's sister was Harriet Beecher Stowe, who wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin, a work of art like film that told a story that began to change the tide, right? So this is how it works, at least how I see it when I look back at history. And I feel determined that my life will be one chain in a long chain of people who were social critics and who fought for justice. I can't send children out into the world if the climate is going to fall apart all around them and there are no pollinators to provide them food and no plankton in the ocean to provide them oxygen. If I have knowledge that all of these things are in trouble, and they are, the very life support system for humanity, then I have to do what's required of me and do it with my whole heart. And so are all of us. So my biggest problem is actually not the oil and gas industry, which is the most powerful industry I know, because we can have victories there. We have our defeats too, but even through defeat, we learn tactics, we learn strategies, we build a movement. My biggest problem is actually people's own self-defeatism, people who think they're so clever that they can sit on the sidelines and predict that, you know, there's no chance of winning, so they're not even going to join in. That's not the spirit of the French Resistance. That's not the spirit of abolitionism or suffragettes. And I'm on their side. I'm on the side of David. We just need to build our slingshot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really, you know, that's really interesting. I, you know, there are people who are on the sidelines. I regularly encounter with them and, you know, engage with them in various ways. And it is really, you know, it is something to be addressed. I mean, I know people, and this is why I asked the earlier question of you about, you know, the way you see your role as a mother. Because I know people who find the kind of information that that you and I and Chanda and so many other people are aware of just too painful to look at. They don't want to know about it. It's too upsetting because they think of it impacting their children. And so because of their love and their concern over the vulnerability of their children, it is for those precise, loving, and caring reasons that they want to kind of push away what's going on in the big picture until it comes to their very doorstep, you know. So it's kind of like cultivate your own garden is a very rampant cultural message here in the United States. You know, that's part of the American dream. And so the models that you mentioned and the demands of the time are really that cultivating your own garden, which isn't enough. I mean, it's not enough of a response to the threats, and yet we have been inculcated in doing that and feeling good in doing it and reinforcing others in doing it as if, you know, that, I mean, in ordinary times where there isn't this kind of battle for the survival of so many species, including our own on the planet, that is a noble thing to do. But, you know, how do we help people through that shift? in this changing time. It seems like a lot of people are having trouble waking up to that or dealing with it and wanting to hide, actually, or something.
Well, right. Again, we need more stories to show people doing something other than that, right? Again, that's why I think Shanda's work is so important for us right now. And look, we can't cultivate our own garden if there are no pollinators left. You're not, the flowers won't turn into fruit anyway. I mean, your garden is connected to the ecosystem, number one. And number two, there were plenty of people who decided to spend, you know, who were lived in Nazi Germany and spent that time redecorating their homes and keeping their heads down. That was not a moral thing to do. You know, it's a form of cowardice to think that you can love your children and not engage with the ecosystem right now, because our kids depend on all of the world's plants to provide us all of the oxygen. We breathe in a half a pint of atmosphere with every breath we take. Half of the oxygen that we need comes from the world's land plants. The other half comes from the world's plankton stocks, and climate change is threatening them both. So that is an issue of prenatal care. That's an issue of parenthood. Just as you would not turn away and pretend it's too depressing if a pedophile moved into your neighborhood, or if, you know, that your school taxes were allowed your local school district to cut all the music programs, the marching band, and the football team. You know, you'd have an opinion about that. You would take action on that. And there's a role for people to play in this larger movement. And I think people just need to see where the entry points are. And I think the film Unfractured goes a long way in showing us some of those. I mean, look, I'm kind of a nerdy, quiet, data-driven person who would like nothing better than to just think contemplative thoughts. I'm so not hands-on, even though I have a PhD in plant ecology. I can't keep a houseplant alive. You know, I'm just... I'm not good for and teaching, and I'm by temperament a kind of academic person, and yet I felt that the moment required me to turn myself into something else, and that's what the film captures, is that transformation, and I think we're all called on that, to become what the historical moment requires of us. I think there are probably a lot of really introverted people who worked really hard in the French Resistance, right? Worked really hard to win rights to vote, worked really hard to help slaves escape. And we need all these stories so that we, because the stories we tell ourselves about who we are and who what the other people are who, around us, help us transform and become the people that we need to be. Bill Pinkegibbons is actually really smart on this point, and he's probably more introverted even than I am. Bill McGibbon, founder of 350.org and climate leader, and he would like nothing better than to stay in his cabin, right, and go cross country skiing. But as he said, Sandra, the moment requires us to be something else, and you can cast yourself against type for a while and just go out and do what needs to be done. So I often imagine, well, if Bill can lead this super public life, then I can manage it too.
Thank you. That's great. I mean, that's a great story and a great sharing. You know, Shanda, what do you see in terms of, like, the kinds of stories that, you know, I mean, what you've done in Unfractured, which I hope people actually go see. If you're in New York, you can see it this coming Saturday at the IFC Center. And it's playing, I believe, at 2:30 in the afternoon. You can also follow the Unfractured Facebook page to keep current with upcoming showings of the film. But, Shanda, what do you see as the stories that will be the kind of ennobling, encouraging, motivating stories? What do we need to see? What do we need to hear to help more people seize their best life? I mean, my teacher was Joseph Campbell, and, you know, he was basically like, I mean, his message was, I think his message, follow your bliss, has been distorted to mean, you know, do what feels good to you. But what he's really saying was do the life that you're called for in the time, not the life that, you know, you thought you could construct through a to-do list and then, you know, will through your own intentions, perhaps. You know, what if the life that we're all called to is different than the life that we thought we were setting out to live, that in a way we're trying to, a lot of people are trying to hold on to, for those who are privileged enough to do so, rather than allowing the call to what you have to give to this time to be heard and acted on. What stories do you see as being important for people?
Well, I always, my films always focus on women's stories. Those are the stories that draw me. And in particular, you know, ordinary women. Now, Sandra is a biologist and a mother, and she's, as you said, won lots of awards, and she's an amazing writer and public speaker. But, you know, at her core, she's a regular woman like you or I, with struggles and challenges. And so that's why Unfractured tells both kind of the heroic story, but also the story of struggle, because I really wanted people to see that it requires both of those things. And I was hoping that what people would see is that it was hard for Sandra, because I've been in many auditoriums where people have praised her and given her standing ovations. But they put her up on a pedestal so high sometimes that I feel like they don't think they could do the same thing. So what I was really hoping for with this film was for people to see that it is a struggle for her, and that it will be a struggle for us too if we choose to take action, but that we all need to be doing it right now. But I also wanted them to feel hopeful, right? Because I wasn't sure how the film would turn out. I didn't know what the ending was going to be. I didn't know if New York was going to ban fracking, but it did, and it was amazing, and it's an amazing moment in the film. And so when people walk out of the theater, I want them to feel like they can do anything, because I believe that if we work together and we try our hardest, we really can do anything, and we have a lot to do right now.
Yeah, we sure do. One of the things, too, is that I think in our society the messages are that you're kind of responsible for your individual life. You have to take care of that first. And if it's not something that you could personally solve on your own, you know, through, say, recycling or riding a bicycle or something, you know, if you can't solve the global climate crisis, you know, it's like if we all got on a bicycle, somehow we could all do it. So I will get on a bicycle, and then I'll exhort everybody to get on a bicycle. That's the kind of thing. And yet Bill McKibben has said, you know, these local actions are not, you know, completely worthless, but they're not going to go far enough to halt the trajectories that we're on. So we really are actually, you know, we've been trained to think about, like, what an individual solution would look like and, you know, what control of my individual life would look like. But really what you're describing is a joining together, a coming together. I mean, and this is what we experienced in the New York fracking movement, you know, a tremendous joining of hearts and minds and caring people to do it together. You know, and people call activists angry, and of course there's a lot to be upset about nowadays, but, you know, could either of you speak to the point about, you know, the constructive use of anger and injustice or outrage over harm, or, you know, how in the setting of activism, for people who are not familiar with it, that can really become and does become a constructive force?
Well, I think anger can be a really strong motivator. It's hard for people to listen to someone if they're shouting all the time. But I think personally, I am angry. I do get angry quite a bit. But it's what drives my work. There's a power in it. You know, it's almost like solar energy or something, a little bit of anger added in there. It kind of makes me go farther. You know, I think the alternative to anger for those of us who are paying attention is just a despair and a sadness, but despair is paralyzing. And so I think that the alternative anger really is better. But Sandra talks a lot about love too, and how love really has been her driving force, her love for her kids and her love for the larger world. And so when I think about the work that she does, I mean, she can speak to whether she's angry or not, but what shines through for me is the love that she exhibits in the fight that she's waging.
Well, that's my perception too. I mean, Sandra, I think you give a message of love and of moral self-accountability, and you know, a form of, you know, taking stock. And I think it's easier to take a stand on moral integrity if you have consistently built your life on that all along. And I think, you know, in many ways you are a model of that. And I think many people have not. They may come from having made compromises. I mean, whether it's, you know, being part of the gas and oil industry or other kinds of compromises. I mean, how do people in this time really rediscover the right, the kind of moral centeredness that's really needed, so that we're not, for example, thinking we can have it both ways? Oh, I can be involved in the political process and, you know, candidates who run with gas and oil money, you know, maybe, you know, and accept that compromise, maybe they're going to be able to be okay, you know. Like, how do we separate, you know, how do we build that moral muscle?
Yeah, well, that's, you know, it's an ongoing conversation, and my ideas on that change all the time. And I mean, again, I've been thinking a lot about this on Election Day. We have a lot of big decisions on the ballot. One of them is whether or not open our Constitution up in the state of New York to a constitutional convention. That comes up on the ballot every 20 years. I took a good hard look at that and decided, no, that's the wrong moment to do. It's the wrong moment to do that. We need to stay laser focused on other issues, and we have these gerrymandered Senate districts that we would be voting from delegates from. We have unlimited dark money thanks to Citizens United. The last time we opened up our convention and modified it was 1938 when FDR was in the White House and labor unions were strong, but that's not this moment. So what was right in 1938 is not right today. That's where I came down. There are lots of people who I admire who believe that that's a terrible compromise, that, in fact, we have to believe that we, the people, could open up our Constitution, lay it on the table, and make revisions and make it even better. So there's a – on my own Facebook page, there's a, you know, a back and forth on that. And as Rebecca Solnit, who's one of my favorite environmental writers, points out, that our vote is a chess move. It's not a Valentine, right? And so you have to be – strategic. Some people, what is interesting to me is that there are men on my Facebook page who are referred to me as frightened when I think I'm being strategic. It's like, that's an interesting word, because that's not how I feel when I'm a political person. I mean, so where does that come from? Like, why are men so quick to refer to women as frightened when we take a look at all the chess pieces and decide that this is not the right move right now? So there's a lot of gendered things going on, for sure.
Yeah, for sure. How, you know, since we're talking about that, where do you see the current, you know, Me Too issue, or, you know, the experiences and harms or traumas that, you know, so many women have experienced? Is that something that is peripheral to, for example, our activism work for the planet, or is it connected to it in some kind of way? How do you, you know, because it's like, how does that, for example, fit in to our environmental work, in your estimation? Or not?
I think so many of us have experienced sexual trauma of various kinds and harassment, and have women have learned to keep their heads down and told themselves that things are fine when they're not fine. And so for some women, that's a real animating force in their own activism. And for others, it has prevented them from being activists because they've become risk averse. So it affects us, for sure. For me personally, my trauma comes from being highly medicalized, from having been a cancer patient since 20, having undergone more cystoscopes than probably any living person at this point. I'm almost 60 now. And having spent so much time in the stirrups, having spent so much time seeing the most intimate parts of my body look like, you know, shadows of Bigfoot on the big screen ultrasound thing with everyone huddled around trying to decide whether that's normal or not normal. I mean, those are terrifying, terrifying moments. Mm-hmm. And so my own sense of having been violated comes from my medical experiences, not from so much, being harassed on the job or rape, although, like all women, I've had some experience with sexual assault. But so for me, the way it played out, interestingly enough, is I discovered I'm a really good prisoner. I'm really good at going to jail. and I know that sounds counterintuitive, but it's because I'm so good at dissociating from my own body when I need to, you know, send my consciousness up into the ceiling tiles and just get through this really awful procedure that makes me really good at, like, I'm not freaked out in handcuffs and manacles. I mean, it's like being on an IV drip or being in an MRI machine or something. For me, being in a jail cell, I'm not medicated. I can read, I can write, I'm good. And I know how to kind of get along with my fellow patients or my fellow inmates. I know how to get along with my nurses or my correctional officers, you know, and get what I need. And so I brought a whole skill set into the jail cell with me that comes from my experience having cancer. The woman in the jail cell next to me, Colleen Boland, retired after a lifetime in the military. And so she brought to her experience in jail. It was like, for her, going back to boot camp. You know, people are yelling at you. You don't have any privacy. And you're ordered around. You can't make decisions on your own. You just have to follow orders. For her, the stress of that world was like something else that she knew. So she brought a whole different set of autobiographical associations to the experience of incarceration, but it allowed her to cope. You know, she brought her own skill set to that. And because she's really good at thinking about morale and keeping up morale, we had side-by-side cells, and so we could help each other through that whole experience. And so I think what I'm saying is I think in some cases women's
Well, you know, thank you so much, Sandra Steingraber and Shonda Chavanis, for being with us today and, you know, telling us about your film, Fractured, which is premiering in New York at the International Film Center this coming Saturday, 2:30 p.m. Listeners, please go to the Unfractured Facebook page to follow along with upcoming screenings of the film or find out about that. I hope New York community will show out in force to see this extraordinary movie. And, you know, this has been such a beautiful conversation. I remember the last time, Sandra, that you were on the show, the same thing happened. You know, it's really wonderful to unpack some of these things, and I hope that it's helpful to embolden and encourage the heroism in all of us and the people who will be listening to this. Listeners, you can go back into the Connect the Dots archives, which is at connectthedots.podbean.com for the earlier interview with Sandra. Please do pass this along. Let people know about Unfractured. Go to see it yourself. Thank you once again, Sandra Steingraber and Shonda Chavanis, for joining us today in Connect the Dots.
Thanks for having us, Allison.
And thank you, listeners, for being with us. We'll be back again next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. And every week I have this close, which is chin up, keep marching forward, and standing tall with all our relations.